listening to the Pharmacy Podcast Network.
In a world where one-size-fits-all medications dominate the pharmaceutical industry, precision medicine brings a ray of hope for those seeking customized healthcare. Pharmacists have a unique opportunity to help people in need of specialized testing to ensure medications work as intended. Welcome to Precision Health in PGX, where we unravel the wonders of precision medicine and its potential to revolutionize the way we approach pharmacy care. Get ready to uncover the secrets behind pharmacogenomics and how it's transforming lives, one genome at a time.
Hey, this is an exciting opportunity for the Pharmacy Podcast Network as we continuously level up, as continuously change content to fit the needs of our pharmacists. Roles are evolving in pharmacy. Pharmacists are taking on roles that we've never thought of before with the intense amount of information and education that's coming in from multiple sources of supplements and science and artificial intelligence. Pharmacogenomics has always been incredibly fascinating to me. I was so excited to meet up with Dr. Banaz Sarami and Dr. Becky Winslow, who took command of PGX for Pharmacists. And now it's evolving as the role of pharmacists are evolving as well. And with that, I'd like to bring on Dr. Becky Winslow and Dr. Banaz Sarami and announcing our new show. I guess we could call it an evolution.
And, yes, definitely.
I'm going to turn it over to Becky and just announce to the Pharmacy Podcast Network some of the alterations and changes and enhancements that we're making.
Thanks, Todd, for the introduction. You're absolutely correct. We've been hanging out together talking about pharmacogenomics for quite a few years now. And just like we evolved the PGX for Pharmacists podcast into an educational platform not so many years ago, we're proud and happy to announce that we're going to expand on the PGX for Pharmacists podcast. We have rebranded as the Precision Health and PGX podcast, which is exciting for us because we've been dying to talk to you about more expansive topics. We're not straying from PGX for Pharmacists.
Not at all.
But we are going to be bringing you a much broader information topics so that, so we're evolving just like the practice of pharmacy has evolved for pharmacists. Banaz?
Yeah, that's correct. It's, the forefront of healthcare innovation. We're really, again, still doing PGX, but kind of broadening the type of guests we bring in. So we'll bring you more information on precision health as a whole, which I think is really great.
Yep.
That's awesome. All right. Well, I'm turning the show over to you as the professionals. I'm going to get out of here. I am not the pharmacist nor the physician or the scientist. So I'm so excited about you bringing on such high level and intelligent guests to really dive into some of these topics that pharmacists really want to hear and nerd out on. So with that, I hope you are anything that you need, let me know along the way, of course, but we're excited to introduce your first guest. So away we go.
Yeah, we're excited to have Dr. Jason Kafer on, and he's an assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at University of Missouri Columbia. He is certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology and also the American Board of Preventive Medicine. His prior clinical experience include working at an inpatient psychiatry at Fulton State Hospital and outpatient at Comprehensive Health System. In 2007, he founded Iconic Health, which is a medical informatics startup that obtained angel round funding. He was also the principal investigator for phase one and two small business innovation research grants for online rural telepsychiatry platform that was funded by the United States Department of Agriculture. Dr. Kafer is also an inventor of the United States patent, which was a subject of an SBIR grant awarded by the Department of Health and Human Services for Medication Iconograph, I hope I said that right, Visualization of Complex Medication Regimen. He has an amazing website and books written such as Kafer's Psychopharmacology. I could take up the whole entire podcast talking about you, Dr. Kafer, but I'll let you introduce yourself and just tell us how you came about this amazing path of Iconograph, if I said that correctly.
Okay. Sure. Yes. Haven't talked about some of those things for a while. It's sort of my distant past, but starting, I guess, near the end of my residency at University of Missouri, Columbia, about 20 years ago, I had this startup venture that was called Iconic Health. And it was this platform for online telepsychiatry with an electronic medical record that incorporated some visuals to help process medication management, essentially. Essentially, it was a big bust. I mean, we did raise a lot of money, and we made some progress on it, but it's been an abandoned idea. But I'll show you the innovation that was in that. I can go ahead and this one up. Okay, so these are iconographs. They never got made, but they are a data visualization tool for a medication regimen. And so envision these little stamp-sized iconographs on a screen, one of each for a medication in the patient's list that tell you several pieces of information, some of it reference material about the medication, some of it in the patient's relation to the medication, like, hey, how big of a dose is this really, in case the prescriber may not be familiar with a certain medication. How long have they been taking it? What's their impression of it? Are they compliant with it? This sort of thing. But I've always been fascinated with pharmacokinetics. And, you know, 20 years ago, I thought they were impossible to learn, to memorize. And so, hey, I want these on my screen. I want my computer to tell me what's the effect of these medications together. And so on the lamotrigine iconograph there, I've got some arrows pointing downward, which is reflects that induction effect of carbamazepine on the metabolism of lamotrigine. And also this would display metabolizer status. So if they were a poor metabolizer of UGT1A4 that metabolizes lamotrigine, there'd be some up arrows there. Mm-hmm. So just kind of that bar at the left is the relative dose. And yeah, this is something I really haven't thought about at all for 10 years, but that's, that's what this is about. Since this idea never came to fruition, my next step was, okay, I got to deal with these interactions as a prescriber. So I guess I just need to learn them. And so I devised a method to do so.
And is this the first time everyone's seeing it for after 10 years, so we feel very privileged.
It's been, nobody's seen it for probably,
that's awesome.
10 years. I don't think anybody's talked about it.
Oh, nice. Okay. Wow. Just right here on Precision Health and PGX podcast. That's of it. That's awesome. I love it. Okay.
Absolutely.
So, do you have any more slides from 10 years ago? We'd love to see it.
we tried to do too much. Okay. So we should have just gone with the online telepsychiatry platform because we had this internet video wasn't very good back then, nothing like this. And so we just had a very primitive portal, and I did do some online telepsych back then. One of the first people to do it. And we just tried to put in so much technology in it, and you can blow a lot of money really fast.
Okay.
For sure.
So are you applying genetics data to with that, or how are you using to use that?
So yes, back then it would have been incorporated in the visualized medication list. So yes, it would have been in there. So as well as these things get incorporated into EMRs.
Sure.
I mean, most EMRs don't really incorporate that data right now. I know at the VA, they do, I'm told they do a pretty good job of it there. That is part of the medication ordering process, that if there are pharmacogenetic factors that will be alerted to those. Nice. But a lot of them know.
Well, tell us about your book.
All right. So anyway, this is Visualize to Memorize 270 Medication Mascots. And so things I'll be talking about here are the things in the first book, Medication Mascots and Interaction Avatars. And then at the end, I want to give a preview of these molecules that are going to be in the second edition that I'm writing this year, hopefully to come out next year.
Hopefully we get a signed copy. Okay.
Yes, certainly. Okay,
thank you.
Please. Now, this is exciting because I'm a visual learner. So if you can show it to me, then I will get it faster. So I'm excited about this.
Yeah, I'm a visual learner to the extreme. Uh-huh. And it's interesting. So I've been interviewing pharmacy residents for the, I'm a preceptor for the pharmacist through Fulton State Hospital. And I always ask them, hey, how do you mm-hmm. learn? What sort of mnemonics do you use, or what sort of visual? And they just don't have any. Which is really amazing. Now, with physicians, I mean, all the medical students are subscribed to these sketchy and picmonic, they're called. They use these memory palace like techniques to memorize a bunch of information. And it just amazes me. Pharmacists amaze me. They just memorize. It's like their brains are different than ours.
Had we known about this,
So anyhow, medication mascot. So the idea is that every medication has its representative that ideally would bring a couple things in for your memory here. So we've got dueling symbols here for Cymbalta, duoxetine. So if somebody says Cymbalta and you can remember this, you can pair and, oh yeah, that's duoxetine. And so ideally the mascot also would convey some piece of information about the med. In this case, it can be hepatotoxic. And so we've got lumateperone cap lighter, illuminated cap lighter. Comes in 42 milligrams.
I'm catching on.
So antipsychotics, they're represented by spooky mascots. So that's another piece of information that's in here. So that's Sarah Quit Typing. Seroquel is really good for mania. So, get typing.
Do these just come to you, or like, I could never have thought about that.
I've been doing this since residency also. Just very slowly, adding mnemonics this way. And then recently I'm getting pretty decent with the artificial intelligence image creation. And so this is one that I made through that. So brexpiprazole. So it's not a T-Rex, but a B-Rex. Rex Salty. And he's got some salt. Oh. lots of interactions with this one. Fluvoxamine. So Lovox, Gluvox, carbamazepine, lots of interactions with this one, as you know. So Tegretol, Tiger Tail, and the car maze. So when I show you these avatars, the ones that have a tiger theme are related to carbamazepine.
Okay.
And again, it's just directionality. I've always been terrified of directionality with interaction. So if it's something that I need to be giving 50% dose of something and I get the direction wrong, I'm going to be giving 200% of what I'm supposed to do it and really have a horrible situation. So I was like, I got to memorize these. And, when it comes to the concept of enzyme induction, okay, we're making more of an enzyme. And so it's just a couple mental steps to go through. But for me, it's like, okay, let's simplify it. It's just up and down. All right. Mm-hmm. So if I've got an inhibitor, it's going to increase levels of stuff. So inhibition, high and hurried. And induction, it's going to decrease. So it's a down arrow, down and delayed. So that's what the loading icon is for. So it's going to be delayed while your liver is ramping up production of more enzymes. Okay. Interaction avatars. So this is for CYP1A2, and I've got, word mnemonics for all these two. So 1X2 grind is how I decided, okay, this was going to be an X. So anything that is a CYP1A2 inducer is going to be represented as an X, and that's going to decrease levels of anything that's a tree. So any 1A2 substrate would be a tree. So we've got carbamazepine now with a tiger theme. It's the Tiger X. And, you know, one of the trees could be the Cymbalta tree. So duloxetine, it's a substrate. Anything that's an axe is going to chop down anything that's a tree. Tobacco, chopping down the tree also. And so about 52% of individuals are 1A2 rapid metabolizers. So they have this effect too. And so, you know, when you count them and you count the smokers, I mean,
yes,
most everybody's a 1A2 rapid metabolizer. And this is one of the things I see on these pharmacogenetic test reports that people get all excited about when somebody's a 1A2 rapid metabolizer, but it's, yeah, that's kind of a nothing burger. There's one for
nothing burger
that are more important that I'll show you. All right. 3A4, 3A's for fishing. So this is over half of prescription drugs, I'm told, are 3A4 substrates to some extent. And now when it comes to representing them, you got to figure out, okay, what's clinically relevant. If it's clinically relevant, I want to make a visual for it. If not, I want to not. So anything that's a bobber is going to increase levels of anything that's a fish. So fluvoxamine is increasing quetiapine. And here's the lumateperone. I plugged that jack-o'-lantern in here, so that's a fish. So anything that's a bobber is going to increase levels of lumateperone. And the opposite, induction. So down and delayed, basically you're dropping anvils on top of the fish and making them go down. Mm-hmm. So carbamazepine decreases quetiapine about sixfold. And this is one of the most neglected interactions I see. I see all the time carbamazepine and quetiapine or lurasidone or this next one, lumateperone again. So 20-fold decrease. It's an expensive drug, and I see this all the time, and pharmacists don't call us about it. But this is, one that I've memorized.
So for the last one with Sarah in the car. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wait, was it not the car?
See, you're Sarah, quit typing.
Yeah. So the two of them, you're saying we shouldn't do together. So Sarah, you can say Sarah doesn't want to be in the car, or Sarah doesn't like to drive a car. I don't know. You're making me now think like you. Oh my gosh.
So carbamazepine's always got to be the tiger. Always got to be a tiger.
So Dr. Kafer, I have to share with you that for the last 5-6 years, I've been creating educational content around pharmacogenomics. And I have, it'll be sad to compare to your pictures, but you have put my PowerPoint smart arts to shame. Because thus far, that's what I've used, is however I can use a smart art to try to represent these interactions. And I'm not certain they were always the clearest to anyone besides me. So kudos to you for making it much simpler.
Oh gosh, okay. Yes.
It's a matter of a lot of Photoshop, and I use Wombo by Dream, and I just kind of feed the images into Wombo, and just kind of keep feeding them in until it gets something that
until it rings the bell.
Right? Yeah, it's like okay,
that's a lot of work. I couldn't do
that's
it.
A cool fish. Yeah, but it's fun. All right. So more now with the pharmacogenomics. And I see the best way for prescribers wanting to understand pharmacogenomics is to first understand the medication interactions, and then when it comes to the pharmacokinetic genes, at least, and then that'll give you the context to understanding these metabolizer phenotypes. So we've got, 2D6. So anything that's a pump is going to be increasing the levels of anything that's a beach ball. And not all these 2D substrates are beach balls. Some of them are bowling balls. Okay. So these would be the 2D6 pro drugs. And it's going to have the opposite effect. They're just simply going to make it not work. There's no such thing as an inducer of 2D6, but we've got rapid metabolizers of 2D6. We got poor metabolizers, and so their beach balls If you're a normal metabolizer, the air leaves the beach ball at a normal rate. If you're an ultra-rapid, it's leaving much quicker. And if you're a poor metabolizer, your beach balls get inflated. So more of the drug because of your genotype. Mm-hmm. And so how this could apply to Rexulti, B-Rex, the B Tyrannosaurus Rex. So normal metabolizers, normal blood levels you'd expect. For a rapid metabolizer, you would expect that the blood levels to be smaller. And for poor metabolizers, it's going to be double. And the label recommends that you cut the dose in half in that event. Also, poor metabolizers are not going to have a good time probably with tramadol and codeine.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they just don't work because you're not converting codeine to morphine or converting tramadol to whatever you call the active form of tramadol. And this is one thing that I think is kind of fun. If I suspect, like, for instance, if somebody's allergic, if you see they're allergic to tramadol and codeine, that's a pretty good sign they might be a 2D6 poor metabolizer because they're just getting all the side effects without any of the benefits. And they speculate that Elvis might have died because he was a 2D6 poor metabolizer. There was a Carlet podcast where they discussed this. And so he was getting Elvis was getting a lot of prescription medications. And they found after he died, for all of them, he had pretty much normal levels. So he was taking them as prescribed. There wasn't an overdose, but he had a extremely high codeine level with a very high codeine to morphine ratio. And so it was speculated that maybe because he was a 2D6 poor metabolizer, that's what did him in was all this codeine that didn't get metabolized.
That's that just illustrates the relationship between inducers, inhibitors, metabolizer status, and toxicology reports. So, yes, in toxicology, I've often been asked, how does this person have so much of the parent drug still present in the specimen and very little of the active substrates? So, absolutely. That's how it ties together.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't see why anybody's prescribing codeine anyway, but.
Sure.
Okay. And some more, this one's relevant to psychiatry because several of our antidepressants are 2C19 substrates. So 2C, nice things grow. Anything that is a watering can grows flowers. So fluvoxamine will increase blood levels of CYP2C19. Substrates like escitalopram, which is one we prescribe quite a bit. The tricyclics that can be kind of dangerous if you have this sort of interaction. And here's some visuals for, poor metabolizers and ultra-rapid metabolizers here. So poor metabolizers, anything that's a flower, 2C19 substrate, they're going to be growing more flowers. The ultra-rapid metabolizers are just going to be chopping the flowers down. Lots of pictures.
That's awesome.
A lot of pictures.
Yeah.
And examples that would be especially relevant are tricyclic antidepressants.
Oh my gosh. I would not have thought about to put a tricycle.
TCAs. Yeah.
I know the tricycle.
Yes.
That's awesome.
As far as the tiger tail and the car maze, the other visual I have amid the tiger is a car. So it's a tiger car. So there is a car. You didn't just imagine that.
Okay.
All right. And one other thing I want to show you are my ideas for pharmacodynamics of psychiatric medications. This is not in the current book, but it's going to be in the second edition. So you're familiar with the molecules from Stephen Stahl, Stahl's Essential Psychopharmacology. Yeah, I love them.
Who is not?
I love them. I thought about it. I want to get a tattoo of one of these.
Oh, my God.
Yes, but I'm huge Stephen Stahl fan. And so here's one of his molecules. He doesn't call them that, but here are yes, here's my style of the molecules. They're not as, they're not balls, I guess. But so you have, you know, how I'd represent these various mechanisms of action or receptor binding affinities for various things. So some of them are very similar to how Dr. Stahl represents them, but some are different. And here are Dr. Stahl's neurotransmitters. And this is what I'm doing differently. So basically here's my serotonin. So I'm making the neurotransmitters into molecules, treating them like they're medications. Okay. So it's binding and stimulating all these 5-HT receptors. Dopamine, all the D receptors, D1, 2, 3, 4, and also it stimulates an alpha receptor too, kind of some overlap with norepinephrine actually. Mm-hmm. And norepinephrine, and I don't know how clinically relevant this is, but it does bind the dopamine receptors with a weaker affinity than dopamine does, of course, but there is some overlap. When I looked into binding affinities, that's just one of the things I discovered. Difference between epinephrine and norepinephrine is it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. So I got this ring around it. It just won't fit. Acetylcholine, all the muscarinic nicotinic receptors, and histamine, of course, stimulates histamine receptors. So these are my neurotransmitter molecules. And for every molecule, we have an anti-molecule. So serotonin, anti-serotonin. So everything that serotonin stimulates, this theoretical anti-serotonin would block. It's blocking 5-HT2, 3, et cetera. Dopamine, anti-dopamine. This would be an antipsychotic. Acetylcholine, anti-choline, anti-acetylcholine, which would be, anticholinergic drug. And an antihistaminic drug, so antihistamine, which is an inverse agonist, actually. That's what the negative signs are. All right, so we've got all our anti-neurotransmitters, and I'm plucking binding affinities off of these, all right? So we got all these receptor binding affinities. We're recombining them, and that's how we're bioengineering a molecule drug. Mm-hmm. So essentially, if one of these binding affinities is blocking D2 receptors, we call it an antipsychotic. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't, we might call it an atypical antidepressant. So this would be mirtazapine, would be a blocker of all of these things. And so what I'm trying to do is kind of make these receptor binding affinities, these pegs, a little more memorable, and show how there are a lot of, say, for instance, antipsychotics that have prazosin effect built into them. They have like a built-in prazosin.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they are memorable. That's for sure.
Yeah. So I'm just, they don't look as elegant as Dr. Stahl's, and I don't want to make them, I don't want to make them too cartoonish, but I want them to be something that at least, you know, helps me memorize the drugs. I write it myself, really. I've got a couple other things that I do think that Dr. Stahl's images could be improved on. Okay. So here's fluvoxamine and sertraline from Stahl's essential. And they look about the same. So you're thinking, okay, there's the only difference between them is that sertraline just blocks dopamine reuptake. It blocks a dopamine transporter very, very lightly, not enough to be called anything other than a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Mm-hmm. They also bind sigma receptors. They're kind of mysterious. But when I think about them, I really, I think about this effect of fluvoxamine inhibiting all these CYP enzymes, especially 1A2, just very strongly. And so there are all sorts of profound interactions between fluvoxamine and other medications. And it's really, core to it, to the drug's essence, really. This is a booster. It's an interactor, whereas sertraline, not so much. It's not going to be clinically relevant, really, in that regard. So that's why I thought these needed improving on, really. So, and so what I'm getting with these molecules that are inhibitors have the up arrow, inducers down and delayed. And the ones that are sensitive substrates, so the ones we have to worry about, look out for things interacting with them, including genes. If you're a poor metabolizer, a rapid metabolizer, the molecules with a hole in it are the ones that you need to be thinking about. And here's what I'm getting with this. So inhibitors are increasing the substrates with the holes in them, and inducers are bringing the levels down like that. So that's how I got a hole. I got the victim and the perpetrator, and things that we don't have to worry about that we can just kind of exclude from our analysis are those that are not an inhibitor, they're not an inducer, they're not a sensitive substrate. So those make life easy. And this is my final slide. In the current book with the avatars, the interaction avatars, the things that are non-interactors, not inhibitors, not inducers, not sensitive substrates, they're in a box. So it's in a glass box. There is a hole on the top of it. Maybe something could get in and interact with it in a pharmacokinetic way, but it really not. We just don't have to think about that much. So gabapentin, for instance. Hmm. And that's how I memorized all this stuff.
Wow. Okay. That was pretty awesome. I don't even know what to say after that. I'm still trying to absorb and digest all the images, and that's pretty cool. Had we had this knowledge, or we actually gained a knowledge afterwards as a pharmacist or the book, oh my God, life would have been so much easier.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Definitely. Remember the drawings on the overhead machine, and but that might be a little further back than you, Benaz.
That's funny. So my question is, this is all great, and so I can see probably students wanting to learn this early on, right? There's clinicians maybe obviously want to learn all this, but how are they going to apply it? So I say that because not even talk about genetics, but just a little bit of the pharmacokinetics and dynamics that we saw, there's still a gap between understanding the knowledge, which you did a fabulous job portraying, but then the application of it in a clinical practice. Or do you see a gap there? Or how do you think the gap could be kind of shortened, if that makes sense?
Well, for one, EMR integration, I think, is really important. And, you know, when I dealt with these tests, I would put the findings in the diagnosis list. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not the only place that you could put them. In the allergy section, for instance. But just however, it just needs to be integrated so that when you're ordering medications, that you have this knowledge. Because so often I see that the patient has these results, but for one, we can't find the report. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, it's not like you can order, you know, insurance are going to pay for a second one of these when their genes haven't changed. And so it's just like the data is really useful, but we just sometimes don't have access to it and don't remember that we have it.
Sure.
So I think that's important to figure that problem out.
I think that's where the importance of patients advocating for themselves and you know, educating patients about how to speak up and say, I have these results, you know, just a reminder, you know, make sure you look at these results. And have had several patients that they were in that situation, that they were able to advocate for themselves. So just that plug for including the patient.
Oh, definitely. And I tell them, hey, take, you know, when you see a new doctor, or if you're hospitalized, take this report with you, you know, make some copies. It is important. Mm-hmm. And yeah, if you don't tell the doctor, we're not going to know about it, because you're admitted to the hospital. You need some medication management. Sure. These tests they're not reported instantly. No. So it's not going to serve any purpose there unless you already have the results and they're ready to go.
Like, yeah, I'm just still remembering Sarah with the carbamazepine on top. I think Sarah was the one that stuck out the most to me. All of them did, but that was my favorite one, Sarah.
Sarah quit typing.
That's what it was. Yes. It is working already.
Absolutely. So you talked about your new book, Dr. Kafer. When can we look for that? Our audience, by all means, I'm sure, will want to know.
So this one's already out, the one without the molecules. And some of the pictures, Sarah doesn't look it's not nearly as compelling with some of the visuals. But so that one's out. It's on Amazon. It's pretty popular among especially nurse practitioners. Yes. I mean, like in nurse practitioner training programs, they're it's just very widely used. I know pharmacists don't know about it. There's a lot of residency programs using it. But the new one will come out. I don't know. I'm hoping I'm done with it in a year.
Okay.
And then, you know, I've got to, you know, get it proofread and reviewed and all. So I don't know. But I'm saying 2025, okay. All the molecules.
We'll hold done. You to that and have you okay. back. Yes.
Yeah. And that's how I heard about you. I'm like, oh, my God, how do I not know Dr. Kafer by now? That's crazy. I heard from a nurse practitioner who pulled it up on a website real quickly. I didn't know if it was an app or it was the book download or something. And I remember I learned from a nurse practitioner that's like, oh, my God, this has saved my life. I'm like, that was awesome.
Yeah,
So in order to get all this information about what type of phenotype they have, which is that you talk about ultra rapid or a rapid metabolizer or a poor metabolizer, they have to do some kind of genetic testing, I assume, right?
Yeah. Sometimes I can predict it, you know, just based on their response to medications. But you really want, you know, somebody who's, you know, they haven't responded the expected way to expected medications, and they've been having side effects that you wouldn't expect at the given doses, and just something's, you know, going on. And that's when you want to order one of these.
Mm-hmm. I gotcha. I know you talked about a few of the genes there. I don't remember if I'm, the pharmacodynamics and kinetic genes. So do you have a favorite one?
Of those, I think 2D6 is interesting. My favorite gene overall, though, is ApoE.
Tell us about
Alzheimer's,
that.
Alzheimer's risk gene. And I'm just really into neuroprotection and trying to prevent dementia. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things out there that have, you know, increase your risk of dementia, you know, 20% or so. And just the idea that if you combine several of these, you know, that somebody who is at high risk for dementia could prevent it. Lithium is the big one. I'm a huge fan of lithium. And just the more that we're learning about that, it's just kind of amazing what it can do, especially with, and we think it's applicable to everyone who might take it, but people with mood disorders, risk of dementia decreased 50%.
Wow.
And just like it. Yeah, just a slowing of the overall aging process, we think. So somebody with a mood disorder on lithium is 3 times less likely to die in any given year. And like men, for instance, who take it from 55, they're 75 or 70% more likely to be alive at age 82. So there's really...
Do you put these nuances in your book?
Some of that, I'm wanting to just write one all about lithium, actually. I see it as important.
Lithium is popular.
For psychiatric. Yeah, it's trendy, yes. Mm-hmm. But for good reason.
We could do a whole episode on lithium because there's a very, very famous gentleman who is studying longevity and how to live longer and healthier while you're living longer. And lithium is one of the micro doses that he incorporates into that longevity plan. Yeah. And metformin.
Metformin. Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard about microdosing of lithium as well. Some people for no other indication but just the cognitive part taking.
Yeah. It's one of the few things that has been shown to prevent mild cognitive impairment from progressing into dementia. And it's gotten more, when it comes to anti-aging, it's gotten more individual mechanisms of how it would work than any other thing out there. I mean,
Yeah.
You know, it used to be microdoses of lithium used to be in 7-Up.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah. I talk about that. I did learn it from, I have to make sure I mention his name since that's where I learned it from, Dr. James Greenblatt. He mentioned the word 7-Up because microdoses of lithium was in 7-Up. And, you know, lithium is a natural element in the periodic table, and it has a molecular weight of 6.94, I believe. So they rounded up to 7. That's how it became 7-Up. So then he talks about, obviously, the value of lithium and microdosing of lithium and how he'd prevented it back then from a lot of mental health issues. And now, since we don't have it anymore in our diet, how that has increased. So it was a pretty good talk. He's awesome.
Yeah. Some places have more of it in their diet than others. Like Northern Texas, they have about 20 times more than we do here in mid-Missouri.
That's me.
Okay. And places, all right.
Any particular restaurant? No, I'm just kidding.
And so it's in the drinking water. It's in the municipal water supplies.
Okay.
And places with more lithium in the water have fewer suicides, fewer homicides, less dementia. So it does something in microdoses, and it's over a long term. Mm-hmm. I don't think microdose is going to do anything for anybody in like a year, but after many years of exposure, it just makes your brain healthier. And I've got another mnemonic for you.
Yes.
It's lithium is the only mood stabilizer approved for use in children, and it's FDA approved for ages 7 up.
Oh my God.
Perfect.
That's awesome. I'm going to use that.
Was that intentional? Did they aim for 7 and up just because of the 7 up drink?
I don't know. No.
There has to be some kind of relation.
If I were on the panel at the FDA, we would have done. But most people aren't worried about us memorizing things. But mnemonics, you know, it's just it's like, you know, memories that are just stored for free, because we'll remember that without effort. Now,
I say this with utmost respect, but where were you all our life when we were at pharmacy school? Oh my gosh. But we appreciate you. We really
Absolutely.
Do. This was really awesome. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you.
We're so grateful.
Thank you. It's an honor talking to you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode. We really appreciate all you're doing, the time you're investing, because education is so important. So thank you for your investment in others. And Banaz?
Thanks for tuning in. And we hope this discussion inspired your curiosity with Sarah. Stay tuned for more scientific insights. We'd love to hear from you. What can we teach you? Drop us a line on LinkedIn. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. So make sure you subscribe and follow us and send us a review.
So until next time, think about the power of precision health and pharmacogenomics and how it impacts you. And we may just be talking about it on the next episode. Thank you.